Alright, I'm glad you are here along with us today, tuned in, because we have an exciting program for you today, about a fascinating topic with an interesting guest. Lynn McTaggart is with us. She is the author of The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe, and her latest book is entitled The Intention Experiment. Lynn also was a part of the film What the Bleep Do We Know, and she also appeared in the follow-up film Down the Rabbit Hole. Very interesting stuff. And Lynn is also coming to Sweden this weekend, I think, and she's going to attend a conference in Stockholm. And we're going to mention that a little bit later on, so you guys out there interested in that can find out more how to attend and so on. The website that you need to take a look at is livingthefield.com. Really nice site with lots of info up there for you. And I know that Lynn is really busy and we got about an hour here today, so I really want to get right to it, as it were. So let's say hello and welcome to Lynn McTaggart. Thank you for coming on and spending some of your time with us today.
It's a delight to be on your show, and I'm very excited about coming to Sweden. It's my first time.
Yeah, it is, huh? Interesting. Why not begin there? Tell us about it. When is it, and so forth?
It's called the Quantum Energy Medicine Seminar, and it's in Stockholm on the 5th and 6th of May, and I'm there on the 5th speaking in the morning. So it should be very exciting. It's the ZEED International show.
There we go. Do you know how much are the tickets, and are they available still?
I don't have details. I think there still are some tickets available, but I think people can find out on the www.xede.fr site.
Okay, well, very good. People can go there and check it out for themselves. So, yeah, as I said, very exciting to have you here. Awesome. Before we dive in and talk a little bit about the field and, of course, your latest book, The Intention Experiment, I'd really like to begin a little bit, talk about you, kind of what attracted you to this research and when you first kind of got into the field. No pun intended there, but what interested you in this subject, Lynn?
Do a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You. It's a monthly newsletter that looks at the conventional medicine, what works and what doesn't in conventional medicine, and also alternative medicine. And I study medical literature to see if there's any scientific evidence for conventional treatments or orthodox treatments, and also if there's any evidence for alternative treatments. And so I've been doing this for a number of years, and I kept coming across studies of alternative medicine like spiritual healing and homeopathy, demonstrating that this stuff works. And I kept thinking to myself, well, if the evidence shows that this works, then something in our understanding of the way the world works must be incomplete. And so I kept thinking to myself, you know, something in our understanding really is wrong about the way the body works. If you can be in one place and send a mental intention to someone else to make them heal, as spiritual healers do all the time, and if that can be demonstrated to work, then our understanding of the body is really incomplete. So I convinced my publishers to let me go on a journey around the world, interviewing frontier physicists and biologists and other scientists to see if they had any idea of why this could be so. I really didn't know what I was going to find. This was an open-ended journey. And what I discovered, and I was amazed, was that each of these scientists working in their respective fields had one tiny piece of the puzzle. It soon became apparent to me that I was going to have to put this puzzle together and synthesize it to see if we could, you know, to see if there was a new view of reality. And indeed, it seemed to be. There seemed to be a new, that these guys were all on a paradigm shift. They were all looking at a very new view of the world that basically drove a stake into the heart of conventional science.
Nice. Tell us about some of the people you talked with on your journey.
Well, I think the hero of the field is a guy called Hal Puthoff, who's a very mild-mannered physicist who was looking for an alternative to fossil fuels in the 1970s. And he thought about one overlooked area of physics that all physicists know about. It's a quantum energy field called the zero-point field. And what it is it's created by the little energy dance that goes on between subatomic particles. All subatomic particles send out energy to other subatomic particles. That, you know, it's almost like passing a ball back and forth. And the one subatomic particle will pass energy out, and another one will receive it, and then they'll send it back. And this little endless energy dance produces an unbelievable, unfathomable amount of energy. You know, if you consider one pass back and forth, it's only about a half a watt of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you count up all the subatomic particles and all the things in all the world doing this energy dance, you come up with this enormous, just indescribable energy field.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we call it zero point because this energy dance goes on even when things are slowed down and so cold that they go to absolute zero.
Hmm.
And that's the thing that is, even at zero point, it still goes on.
Interesting. In your book, I think you mentioned that you tie this together in a way with both inertia and gravity, right?
Hal Puthoff certainly did.
He did.
Realized that if you took account of, you know, the zero point field has always been subtracted out of most equations, physicists' equations, because it messes up their math.
Mm.
And so they cut it out. It creates infinities. So they cut it out. But Hal realized that if you keep it back in, if you don't subtract it out, it will provide answers to things that have always been assumed to just be dictates of physics, you know, you know, laws of physics without any explanation, like inertia, which is, you know, that is the force in the universe that makes things hard to get moving.
Yeah,
and once
sure.
you get them moving, you can't stop them, you know?
Yeah.
And also, gravity, you could count gravity as perhaps a zero-point effect. So he actually published papers about this, arguing for this. But he also realized that there was a big metaphysical implication of this ground state of quantum energy. If there's a quantum energy field made up of all subatomic particles, it means that we're all united by one invisible web, and also that we are in connection and can be in touch with the furthest reaches of the cosmos through this field. So Hal realized there was a very important element here, and it could explain many of the things that we have found unexplainable, like how people pick up information at a distance, you know, how people have an effect on living reality, you know, with their thoughts, things like that. So the quantum energy field seems to be the central explanation for many of these intuitive effects and many of these ideas that native traditions have understood but never had a scientific explanation for.
Interesting. You know, for someone who kind of don't is up to speed, as it were, with you know, the basics of quantum physics and so forth, is there any way to kind of, you know, boil this down in a fairly simple form? Is that possible?
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of basic ideas that make these discoveries so interesting. The first is the idea, and this I elaborate this on both books, particularly in the newest book, The Intention Experiment. In the quantum world, we understand there's a thing called superposition. And basically that means that a subatomic particle isn't a set entity. It's all possible cells. It's just a potential. So what that means is imagine a theater. And imagine a single seat in the theater. Now, normally we think of a person or an entity or, you know, any matter in the universe as occupying just a single seat. It's a set something. It's a finalized assemblage of something. But a subatomic particle isn't just that single seat. It's every seat in the stadium. You know, it's every seat in the theater.
Yeah.
It's all seats all at the same time, all possible cells. Now, what they've understood is the only way that all possible cells turns into a set something is when a scientist observes or measures it. And this is called the observer effect. It means that observation, living consciousness, is somehow intrinsic to making that potential of something, something real. But scientists have always thought that that only occurs in the quantum world. You know, that once a quantum entity begins being part of a bigger thing, like atoms and molecules, it starts behaving itself more like what we understand in, you know, of Newtonian reality. You know, reality is described by Isaac Newton, that things require force, that things operating according to set laws of motion, etc. But latest studies have shown that that's not true, that even big things like atoms and molecules also operate married according to these strange Alice in Wonderland laws, and that big things like molecules exist in a state of superposition. In other words, I'm not quite set something yet. And so that suggests to us that big things, the big building blocks of matter in our sticks and stones world are still influenceable. They are mutable.
So is this kind of the what Werner Heisenberg developed, you know, early on, known as the uncertainty principle? Is it connectable with this in any way?
Yes, it's absolutely connected with that. It's the idea that you could never, that electrons are, or subatomic particles are ultimately unknowable because they're a potential. They're not a set something yet. And now we understand that what Heisenberg thought was just applicable to the quantum world is actually applicable to the world at large. And so this, to many people, makes us understand that our equipment, you know, we haven't had equipment sensitive enough to measure this. Now we do. But it suggests that this, that matter is mutable, that matter is influenceable by the power of thoughts and by living observation. There's another element in this that's very important, which is the whole idea of non-locality. And this word non-locality and entanglement, which is a nice poetic way of calling it, has been always thought again to be a quantum effect. And what this means is, it means that there's an instantaneous connection between two entities, no matter how far you put them apart. So let's say, I always say it's like twins separated at birth. If you take one and you put one in Tokyo and the other one in New York, even though they've never seen each other again, they act identical at the same time. So that one might, they both might marry a woman called Jane, they might, both might like the color blue, and if one falls down and breaks his leg, so does the other one, even though the first one may be skiing and the second one may be just sitting there drinking a coffee in Starbucks. So it's that kind of instantaneous connection and effect occurring across time and space, always, forever. And that is what we know happens in the quantum world in non-locality, but we are now discovering, and scientists are now finding out, that this occurs in the world at large. This occurs among atoms and molecules again. They represent, they create non-local effects. They have instantaneous connections that sometimes override big effects from the outside, like the application of heat or a magnetic field. Things being non-locally affected are operating according to their own internal laws. And so this is, again, demonstration that we are probably far more connected to things out there than we have understood, that we are all connected somehow.
Very interesting. You know, this is about, in a way, communication, in a way. And the interesting thing is that the question is, I guess, what it is, because I mean, inertia in regards to even light, you know, that things can't, you know, travel fast enough. Let's say if we move two things apart, you know, way apart out in space somewhere. But what you're saying, I guess, is that there exists a kind of a communication between them, no matter what the space is. So the question, kind of is, what the heck is that that can travel, you know, faster than light and faster than anything instantaneously, I guess.
Well, what it means is probably Einstein was only part right. Remember, you always have to think of science as a process. You know, it's a process of discovery, and sometimes we get it, and then we move on a little bit further, and we don't, you know, we need to get more. We outgrow our understanding, so we have to understand some more. And so Einstein understood something that seemed very important, but there's probably more to the story, and that's just unfolding now.
It is, yeah. How about, you know, being consciousness itself? Thought is almost an instantaneous way, you know, you can travel, so to speak, you know, with your thoughts to a different place. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're finding that the power of thought is just quite amazing, you know, that the power of thought is demonstrated in all sorts of areas, that, you know, we know that a thought is, you know, people always say a thought is a thing, but actually it's a thought is a thing that affects other things, because there's been demonstration that thought can affect, you know, electronic equipment. This is scientific studies I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Science.
Yeah.
that it can affect all kinds of electronic equipment, random event generators, which are random electronic machines, kind of like an electronic version of a toss of a coin, with random heads and tails all the time. And they've shown thought can affect that, and thought can affect everything living, from single-celled organisms to full-fledged human beings. And it seems to operate outside of time and space. Seems that it doesn't matter when you generate the thought, it still has an effect. Or if you're 3,000 miles away or in sitting in front of the thing, you seem to have an effect. And it seems to multiply. There's some evidence it may multiply in numbers.
Hmm.
In other words, the more people are thinking the same thought at the same time, the more they're having an effect, which is what I'm testing now with my intention experiment.
Very interesting. I just want to tie this back because there's an interesting story about this, I guess, in connection with 9/11, right?
Mm-hmm. There was some evidence. There's a thing called the Global Consciousness Project, which has got, it was started with someone who worked at Princeton University, and his name is Roger Nelson, and he has put these random machines all over the place in the world. They're called random event generators, and they have a, let's say there's a computer, they're in a computer. It would randomly show up two different images, let's say apples and pears all the time. And because it's random, it would operate according to the laws of probability, and so you would see pretty much 50% of the time apples and 50% of the time pears.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just keep flipping back and forth, back and forth. But with this project, they have these all around to see if big things happening in the world, and if people's attention were caught by that, if they'd have any effect on these random event generators. And they found that whenever there was a giant global catastrophe, there would be a big effect on these machines, and they would steer away from their randomness and be a little bit more ordered. In other words, showing more heads or more tails than usual. And what happened was with the biggest effect occurred during 9/11, just before 9/11, actually. The machines really veered off their random course. And so that would suggest that there is some effect on the world from so-called world mind.
But that kind of upsets the law of time, right? Time also, I guess, because if it happened, you know, before people were aware of it, what's going on there?
Well, that's it. I mean, none of these effects seem to be governed by time.
Hmm.
I mean, I think that what we're understanding is that intention and the effect of mind on matter is not sensitive to time. And that time, I mean, the view of most of these physicists is that time as we know it is just a construct, and that we're creating it ourselves, but that time is probably more accurately is just one great big smeared out now.
Interesting. You mentioned, of course, thoughts and obviously, you know, intention and all of this. How kind of would you say that this? What is it, so to speak? If we were to say, for example, in regards to thought, that this influences, you know, not only our surrounding, but I guess even also ourselves, our own health. It connects with so many different aspects. Do you go into all these different areas in your new book?
Well, I not only look at the science of intention, you know, and what exists. I mean, there's been so much evidence for intention being used in every area of our lives, and good science to show how powerful the effects are. But we're also testing it out. I mean, we're inviting our readers to be part of global intention experiments, and we're working with what happened was, as I was studying about the power of intention in numbers, because that was what really interested me. Does it multiply? Does the effect multiply the more people are thinking the same thought at the same time? And my husband turned to me one night and said, well, you know, I couldn't find conclusive evidence. And so he said, well, why don't you do this yourself? And that seemed pretty ridiculous to me because, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a writer. But I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, I've got thousands of readers, hundreds of thousands of readers around the world, and the field is in 15 languages. And I've got many, many scientists that I know very well. Perhaps I could work with them and invite my readers to be part of intention experiments, and that would mean that we could create the greatest global laboratory in history. And so that's what I've done. So the book, in a sense, is a book with all the scientific evidence in it, and, I mean, there's loads. There are 50 pages of bibliography and notes there, so there's loads of science to convince people this is real. But there is also an experiment attached, so that anyone who's read the book should just log on to the website and then be involved in these experiments. And we have so far worked with Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, and we've been sending an intention to affect some physical targets. All living things emit tiny currents of light, a tiny current of photons, tiny bits of light. And we were trying to see if we could manipulate that and increase those biophotons. So we've tried several experiments where we've asked people to take a leaf from a geranium plant and send an intention to make it increase its biophoton emissions, you know, these light emissions. And we've, our instructions have been send an intention to make the leaf glow. And we found in a conference we did that we had an extraordinary effect. We had a control leaves, and we found that we had a hugely significant effect, so much so that special camera equipment that could image it showed in these pictures changes so different you could see them in the, with the naked eye. And now we've tried this now with our 6,000-7,000 readers around the world, and we've had an effect in the right direction with string bean beans. We needed more beans to create a real significant effect, but had we had them, we would have had a significant effect. And it looks like we have to still calculate the ones that we've done 2 weeks ago, but it's looking interesting.
Very interesting. Biophotons, of course, an area that, you know, is very intriguing in a lot of many ways. Do you think that this field then, you know, is kind of the way that we can our interaction with it within ourselves, so to speak, that even our DNA and our cells emit this light, and that in itself is I don't know, do you think that is part of this field that you talk about?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that it is an aspect of it, in the sense that these kind of little light emissions are beaming and receiving instructions all the time. There's a lot of scientific evidence now to show that these light emissions among living things are being picked up by, you know, that one living thing sends out and the other one picks it up and replies to it. There's information, like when they've done studies of fruit flies and flies and little animals like this, they find that there are synchronicities, light beamings out back and forth. So, yes, there's evidence showing that this is coming out of our DNA. This is the body's instructions coming from the DNA, that this is the central orchestra of our bodies. And it's also a communications mechanism with other organisms. And that we are constantly sending and receiving, like a television station and a television set, all at the same time, all at once.
So we're not only we're also, I guess, interacting with it in regards to that we have a form of, you know, free will and all of this. That question comes also, I guess, into the play here. But do you think that this is an interaction? You know, where we receive, as you say, instructions from higher source, as it were, but at the same time we can interact with it and change it and shape it, I guess.
Well, I think that that's true. I think that we're discovering that we all have we're all having a profound effect all the time. We're all beaming and sending and receiving, and with practice, and there's many, many people in many areas of life who understand this and use it. With practice, we can become bigger intenders. We can become a bigger transmitter and a bigger receiver.
You have a chapter in your book called The Voodoo Effect, I think. This is very interesting. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I was very interested in whether or not we can have a negative effect. I certainly found in many areas positive effects, and that there was very powerful effects when sending positive intention. But I wanted to know if there was negative intention too, and if it was just as powerful. And I wish I could say that positive intention is the stronger force. But, you know, I can't. I mean, the evidence shows that, you know, when people are, say, intention masters, like Qigong masters, when they send positive energy and compare it with negative energy, they get a similar effect. You know, that you are just as powerful when you send negative intention, if you're, you know, if you are very focused. And so, and I also think about unintentional intention. I have an example of that in my personal life. My husband and I are like Art Deco, and we had just redesigned our house and renovated our house, and we'd put new taps in the bathrooms, and we'd fixed everything up. And 3 weeks after we did, our cleaner, who was very over-enthusiastic with the scale removal, put scale removal on these taps and stripped all the chrome off all the taps in the house. And it was, you know, an enormous amount of money lost, and I was just so upset. I didn't know what to do about it. I just took to my bed and was upset, and I vented my spleen. And I found out the next week that at the moment I did, this woman had fallen off a bus and broken her leg. And so I just wondered to myself, did I do that? You know, and I have no answer for that, but it certainly made me much, that in a number of other cases like this, have made me aware that, you know, certain negative intention could have an effect. I find if I'm in a very bad mood, I break computers. I have a big, profound effect on computers or even photocopy equipment. And so I find, you know, first of all, I stay away from equipment if, even those few times I have a bad mood. And I'm also trying to be aware of negative thinking and negative thoughts, being having an influence, constant little influence.
You know, going back to the Voodoo effect, this is also... do you know if this has been tried to actually, you know, you go interested a little bit about, you know, not destroying bacteria, but kill, or we could say cancer, I guess, even, you know, going into...
Well, negative intention is the foundation of a lot of healing, because, you know, if you have an infectious agent or cancer, that thing has to die for you to live. And so the visualization techniques of many people who are using visualization and intention to heal is about killing that microbe or killing that tumor. And so that can work. I mean, that seems to work for some people. Other people say you don't need to do that. You just have to send an intention to restore to the natural order. But I think it's really all about what works for individuals. You know, you use intention that works for you. And some people use intention to heal, use that negative intention. Other people don't. They use something different.
So I guess belief is a big part of this too, then, in a way.
Belief is an enormous part of it. And also belief between sender and receiver seems to be important. There's certainly some good evidence showing that when the sender and the receiver both believe, their brain waves and lots of other physiological processes start mirroring each other. And so the belief between healer and healee is central. And they also find that there's a bigger and better effect in somebody who believes and also has an emotional component, also has emotional commitment to it. So you really, really have to understand and believe and focus your, you know, emotion on the idea that this will succeed.
One thing that came to mind was when you talked about the influencing in a way that, let's say, a lot of people are focusing on one thing or let's take the example of terrorism for example. I mean, the fear mode in a way in our society is very, you know, hyped, and a lot of people are in a way focusing on that aspect, and they're afraid of it and so forth. This must be a terrible thing to, you know, actually then laying your focus on this, because this is actually something that can strengthen, I guess, let's say, terrorism then. Isn't that right?
Well, yes, if terrorists all got together and understood how to do this and did it all together as a focus. On the other hand, it may well be that we, as, you know, the objects of terrorism can also block that by sending a very positive intention to stop it, or to send an intention for them to disperse.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, if we, for example, a lot of people are sitting watching television or whatever, you know, the mainstream media pumping out fear, basically, you know, through the tube. That.
Oh, I see.
You see what I mean? Yeah.
Well, my book is really written as an antidote to that, to say that your thoughts are very powerful.
Indeed.
I mean, the whole point of the intention experiment is to always select philanthropic targets. So we have been working on simple experiments like a leaf now, and we're going to send simple intention experiments to human beings too in the autumn. Mm. But we're also going to be moving on to ecological targets like we're creating a little mini Gaia, you know, a mini world like a terrarium, and we're going to artificially raise the temperature and see if we can send an intention to lower it.
Oh.
And that will have profound impact and effect on, or certain implications for global warming.
Oh.
We're also going to try sending intentions to lower crime rate and see if that has an effect.
Hmm.
And that will have a huge implication on lowering crime and violence.
Yeah.
And we're looking at trying to send an intention to purify water, and on and on. And maybe eventually, as we see that, if we understand about this process, we might send an intention to start disbanding terrorists. You know,
yep.
This is the whole point. It's always going to be philanthropic targets with our experiments on the website.
Mm.
Always inviting the readers. As we're doing it now, there's a very lively forum on that site.
Mm.
And by the way, that's our new site, which is www.theintentionexperiment.com.
Oh, okay.
It's our new site where everybody's coming on and using intention. And the readers are already they're nominating people who need intention sent. And we're going to have a bulletin board soon that has a worthy person to be sent intention every week. And so there have been people already who have, this one guy called Don Berry who has a bad back.
Mm-hmm.
So his spine is fused and he can't move it. And he asked our readers, well, really the readers on their own decision, they made the decision to send him intentions twice a week.
Mm.
And he's feeling better. He's keeping a diary.
Hmm.
So we're just keeping track of all of that and keeping in touch with the readers because of that, to see if we can, you know, we can create these kinds of little intentions. Intention experiments, in a sense, every week.
Mm. Oh, fascinating! Yeah. So this is a kind of a very new process and a beginning process, and to be able to outline this. I think this is very important stuff. And also, of course, do you think that influencing things is possible even when you're kind of in an unaware mode, meaning that now we're very, in a way, I guess, focused on stuff, and you're very aware and very present in a way when you think about things. But what about unaware influence? Is that possible too?
Well, very much like me and my cleaner. Yes, I think we're sending and receiving at every moment.
Yeah.
You know, I used to think of mental intention as a very very mental focused attention.
Mm.
But I think we are unintentionally affecting all the time with our thoughts. You know, if you walk around with negative thoughts, and this is the worry, most of us are walking around thinking negative thoughts all the time.
Mm.
If you're thinking negative thoughts, you're having that effect all the time in your life, I think. And the trick is to start turning those negative thoughts into positive, powerful ones, and also learning how to be a good focused intender. Because another thing I did was I interviewed a lot of so-called intention masters, you know, people like Qigong masters and healers and people like that, to see what they all do in common, and found that they all seem to create a mental state of very, very intense focus. And that's when they send intention, and it seems to have a more powerful effect.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, you mentioned water earlier. When you went about and traveling for your book, The Field, did you by any chance get to meet, what is it called, Emoto, Dr. Emoto?
Masaru Emoto. I have met him, yes.
I've
met him, and I think his stuff is interesting, very interesting and intuitive, and it needs science to prove it. I think that his material is wonderfully interesting, and there's certainly been work that has been done by a Russian called Konstantin Korotkov showing that water, its photonic emissions change with positive emotion.
Hmm.
And, of course, water is interesting because water makes up most human beings.
Yeah.
You know, it's most of us.
Yeah.
And it's most of life is water. And they have found with intention that intention seems to affect the hydrogen-oxygen bonds of water. You know, very focused intention by a healer or a Qigong master seems to affect the hydrogen-oxygen bonds. So it changes molecular matter.
Mm.
And also what is very interesting, because in a sense it's like a laser, it seems to, they've discovered that it has what they call coherent domains. It seems to act like a little recording medium for information about something, which is why perhaps homeopathy works. You know, you the water records the signature frequency of some molecule when they're using a particular substance. They dilute it so much that there's only that signature frequency there. There's no substance of the molecule left. And then they use that as medicine. And that may be why it's working, because water is, in a sense, an amplifier.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, because there, as you said, there seems to be a very, you know, special feature to water, and that we are, you know, as you say, a big part of it, and it is us in a way. Fascinating stuff. You know, one thing that I did want to talk about is I began reading in chapter 7 in your new book called The Right Time. I think there was some fascinating info in regarding something called the Chamber of Heaven and Hell. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think that is interesting because that is Michael Persinger's work. Persinger is really interesting because he's a scientist at Laurentian University in Canada, and he was looking at whether or not there are geomagnetic effects on intention. First of all, what we understand is that, you know, the Earth is buffeted by a geomagnetic shield, a geomagnetic ring that rings the Earth, almost like a donut, and the sun is kind of a furious and vengeful star, and it sends, it sends these things toward Earth. It starts sending and flinging, all kinds of things toward Earth, like gaseous explosions, like coronal mass ejections and solar flares, and all these things happen.
Mm.
And space weather, what we consider space weather, is not a vacuum, but is this highly turbulent, atmosphere of all of this activity. And all the time that the sun is hurling this stuff toward Earth, it's affecting the geomagnetic shield, and that increased geomagnetic activity affects us. So when we are, it particularly affects the human heart and brain, and it affects all living things too. I mean, pigeons, homing pigeons, can't find their way home, for instance, with a lot of geomagnetic activity.
Yeah.
But it shows that there's a lot of effect on our heart and brain, so that our psychiatric admissions increase. Our heart, we have more heart attacks when this happens.
Hmm.
All kinds of things. We have more epileptic fits. All kinds of things like that happen. But also, when it's a little active like this, it seems to enhance intention. It enhances mind over matter experiments.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good when there is no such activity for things like psychic ability. You know, when the Earth is calm or geomagnetic activity is calm and not much is happening, that seems to help us to tune in and get more telepathic information.
Hmm.
But when it's a little noisy, that seems to help us with intention.
Hmm.
So Persinger found this because Persinger has created, he's kind of recreated what happens with geomagnetic activity. He's created this Chamber of Heaven and Hell, which is in the basement. It's a laboratory. He's created a motorcycle helmet that courses magnetic fields through the brain, low-level magnetic fields, just like it happens in geomagnetic activity. And he finds if he aims them at the temporal lobes of the brain, he can create the sense of God, the sense of the divine.
Mm. Interesting.
It calls it the Chamber of Heaven and Hell because not everybody got the sense of the divine. Some people have a sense of some satanic creature with, you know, big eyes and the smell of burning sulfur.
Sure.
So some people have a really hellish experience too.
Yeah, and that seems to be kind of, it all depends on you very much and where you're at, because this is, as you say, this is not a energy that has, you know, good or bad intention, I guess. It's just there, and it becomes of what you make of it. Do you agree on that?
Yes. I mean, it seems that people who have had bad early life experiences have a more sensitive right temporal lobe, and people who have had good life experiences are more sensitive left temporal lobe.
Hmm.
And if you have more of a sensitive right one, you tend to get negative experiences with this. If you have more sensitive left, you have happier ones.
Hmm. Interesting. And there seems to be a big connection between consciousness and the magnetic field itself. I know at the beginning of your new book, The Intention Experiment, you mentioned this regarding going down to the absolute freezing point, basically, and looking at the structure of atoms, basically, and see how they rearrange. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I'm not sure. I don't understand the question. Could you explain that again?
At the beginning of your book, you talk about the experiment where I can't remember his name now, but he actually lowers the temperature.
Oh, Thomas Rosenbaum.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, he lowers temperature to a few degrees before absolute zero, so that he can, you know, he can take a substance and have its atomic activity slow down so much that they can look at what's happening. And I think his material is very interesting because he takes these real freakish substances that he helps to create called spin glasses,
yeah,
which are kind of anarchic material whose atoms are magnetic, but they point any which way. And then he lowers the temperature so they're just a few degrees above absolute zero so he can monitor what's going on, because normally at normal temperatures atoms move around too fast for our equipment to measure. And then he starts applying an outside force like magnetic field or higher or heat, a temperature, to see what happens. And he found that what was shocking was they found that as they were applying a magnetic field, the atoms in this material, they started ignoring that magnetic field and operating according to their own rhythm, you know, operating to their own laws, and they were kind of a law unto themselves. And so it made him realize that they were actually displaying non-local effects, that kind of instantaneous connection we were talking about earlier, and that these seemed to override any outside force. So the significance of his findings, for our purposes, is that big things like atoms, as were occurring in this, are non-locally connected in the universe. And so non-locality seems to occur in the world at large. And so that was what was amazing. It was a real find, this information, and really overturned many, many assumptions about the nature of reality.
And this was also a way to, confirm or check if consciousness or thought or intention has a effect on material that on other instances move so fast that you can't actually measure them, right?
Exactly.
Very interesting. You know, what I come to think about also is the study, the consciousness studies done at the Monroe Institute. Is that anything you're aware of?
Yes, the studies with hemisync, yes.
Do you think that they're similar to what the chamber of heaven and hell, so to speak? Is there similarities there?
In a way, I think that they are looking at how you can create something to... first of all, I think the hemisync studies look at the fact that your brain waves can easily go in, using certain sounds, you can easily go into a meditative state. And they use a thing called a binaural beat, which is a beat that's slightly off on one side of the brain and the other, one side of the hearing and the other. And that causes the brain to kind of trip into a place of quick meditation. So it's a very clever way of moving you into a meditative state. I think some of their other studies are looking at this kind of and a resonance effect between people, that you can send and receive information in certain states like this one.
Interesting. You also, I want to kind of ask you, what your work on the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, you didn't appear in the first one, right?
No. I was supposed to. I didn't make it out there.
Okay, but you did work on it, right? Or behind
the
scenes?
No, I didn't work on it. I think they were inspired by it. I think the producers were informed by it. They found it very good source material and were very interested in reading it. They were very happy to find a book that was, from what they tell me, a book that provided the follow-through for how it all fits together. And so it was very helpful for them as they were putting it together. And they wanted me to appear, and there was just some reason why I couldn't get out there.
Sure.
But then they filmed me for the Down the Rabbit Hole, the big version of it.
Yeah, exactly. The kind of the follow-up, I guess. Well, yes. Have you got a lot of, how's the response to your work? Have you got a lot of, response to that movie, I guess? Or how?
Oh, yeah, loads and loads of response. I mean, people seem to really have liked my interview, and I've had a lot of, interest and notoriety as a result.
Mm. How about coming through to, the more mainstream scientific community? Is there any response there? Is it the doors shut, so to speak?
Well, it depends on how open-minded that person is. I mean, there are certain kinds of scientists who are, as they call them, scientific fundamentalists.
Yeah.
They like real certainty, and
yeah.
they believe the old scientific story
yeah.
still holds sway. But anybody, even mainstream quantum physicists, are starting to understand that the discoveries that we're making are really changing that story now,
mm.
and that we have to modify our view about what reality is and how it works,
mm.
and from that create a new story. And of course, that new story affects every aspect of our lives. It affects, all of our life is based on a Newtonian story of, which is very much about separateness. Things
yeah.
are separate, things are finalized assemblages.
Yeah.
And because of that, we create a workplace of separate and competitive, and educational processes of separate and competitive. And the same thing with our societies and our neighborhoods and our world. But if we had a very different scientific story, then we would look at things very differently.
Mm. One thing I did want to squeeze in here before we have to round things off is also, I've been following the work of Wilhelm Reich for a while, or going back rather,
yes.
because he's not here with us, but he talks, of course, about orgone energy, and
yes.
Would you kind of draw parallels between what you do and what he talked about in that?
I think he came up with an idea. Of course, he was thinking about it in Jungian terms,
yep.
but he was thinking about the idea of this ever-pervasive energy field, which he called orgone energy. And it has great parallels in zero-point energy. The only difference is that his was a theory, and mine is grounded in science. I mean,
mm.
we know there is a zero-point energy. They've done studies on zero-point energy to demonstrate it exists.
Mm.
And at the moment, NASA and British Aerospace and many other organizations like Lockheed are working very hard to extract zero-point energy for space travel.
Yeah.
Because if they can, we don't need fossil fuels anymore. We can operate on what they call a cosmic free lunch.
Mm.
We can just take energy out of empty space.
Hmm. Wouldn't that be wonderful at these times, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Well, wonderful. I think this has been an awesome interview, and I know that you're a bit stressed for time, and again, I want to thank you so much for coming on. But before we finish off, I want to give you an opportunity again to mention all the websites you got out there, your books, and of course, how people can get them.
Wonderful. Well, people can get in Sweden, can get our books from, and anywhere, can get our books from www.theintentionexperiment.com. That's theintentionexperiment.com, and that's the website that we are using for all of our online experiments, and where readers from all over the world are participating. We have thousands of people, so we'd love to have more.
Mm.
And they can also access Living the Field, which is www.livingthefield.com, and that is our website for the field, and we have a whole course and material, much downloadable material, about taking these ideas and into your life, because I think that's what we're interested in now, is looking at creating a new scientific story and how to use that in your life, in your work, with your children, in your relationships, to create a new philosophy, all of that. And we've been working on 4 years worth of that material, so that's all available too. So people can look at it for all of that material, and also look at our website, What Doctors Don't Tell You, which is WDDTY for whatdoctorsdonttellyou.com, which is all of our medical information, which looks at what works and what doesn't work.
Very interesting.
And I look forward to seeing people at the Quantum Energy Medicine Seminar in Stockholm on the 5th of May, and that's ZED International, XEDE, and that's ZED.FR.
Wonderful. Again, thank you so much, Lynn, for coming on. Would love to do this again sometime when I have more time for us.
That's great. I'd love to. Take care.
The same.
Bye.
Thank you. Before we round things up today, I just want to mention that we just added a recurring 3 months subscription option for you guys who consider the 6 months option a bit too long. So now you can choose between subscribing for 6 months for €17, that's $23, or you can sign up for 3 months recurring for €9, that's about $12. And at this time, we really do need your help and support to keep it all going. So if you appreciate the work we do here and the amount of time it goes into keeping this thing alive and kicking, as it were, we need all the help we can get at this moment. About 5% of all the people that tune into our show has chosen to support us with a subscription so far. So I hope that you do consider supporting us if you're not a subscriber. Click on the subscribe button from our front page and help us out. All right, thank you so much for tuning in, for caring, and for your interest. Also, a big thanks to Fredrik for handling the controls. We will be back on Sunday with a whole new program for you. Again, thank you for your help and support. Take care, guys. We'll talk more soon.